And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm happy to welcome Chris Bojalian to the program today. Chris is a prolific best-selling author, having enjoyed much success, commercial and critical, with novels like Midwives, The Double Blind, and The Sandcastle Girls. Doubleday has recently published his 17th novel, The Guest Room, about a horrific bachelor party and its effect on one family and the young women forced into the sex trade far from home. Chris, as the guest room opens up, Richard Chapman, who's 40, is hosting a bachelor party for his 35-year-old brother Philip at his own home. Why on earth did he think hosting a bachelor party at his Bronxville home was a good idea?
I have met so many men who had bachelor parties at their homes. I've actually been to bachelor parties at private homes, but I understand the question. You're not the first person to wonder at the utter lunacy of this idea. I think in the case of Richard Chapman, he was hoping that it might be less of a bacchanal. It would be less degrading, less reprehensible than if it were at some of the other more traditional venues for a bachelor party.
I must be one of the only men in America who's never been to an official bachelor party.
You haven't missed anything. They're degrading and they are appalling. There are few traditions in this country as weird and reprehensible as a bachelor or bachelorette party. And that's one of the things that I hope the book deconstructs a little bit. One of my favorite scenes in the books occurs when Richard's wife, Kristen, is chatting in a coffee shop with another public school teacher, one of her friends, about the whole notion of why do bachelor parties exist? What's the deal with strip clubs?
I have no idea.
No, there is no place more depressing in the world than a strip club. As one of the characters says in the book, the women who work there know that the men are kind of ridiculous and pathetic or sexist or all of the above. They are being taken advantage of in ways that are emotional as well as fiscal. No good comes from a strip club. And I'm not a prig. I probably sound like a prig. I'm just not. And I think that the exchange between that school teacher and Kristen Chapman in the book is really interesting because of their cultural debate about everything from lap dances to strip clubs to why was the bachelor party in a private home in a suburb.
It's like none of these guys have wives or mothers or sisters that they can actually empathize and sympathize with someone else who might not be related to them.
Right. The utter objectification, not just of women, but the objectification of young women.
Now, Richard is an investment banker at a very stodgy firm, and Philip is in management at a trendy boutique hotel in Manhattan. He's not the front desk manager, but he's a rooms executive. What in the heck is a rooms executive?
I've got to give a shout out to a great book. Jacob Tomsky wrote a book called Heads in Beds, chronicling his brief career working in different hotels. And that's where I learned that term. And when I was talking to Jacob about it afterward, he was great explaining to me what a rooms executive does, what a front desk executive does, who is in charge of making sure that the rooms are going to the right people at the right time and have the right amenities.
In a upscale hotel, that's a very, very demanding job, I would guess.
Certainly it is for in New York City. Might be in Memphis, too, or Nashville or Chicago.
Well, whenever you have people spending a lot of money, they have expectations.
They do. They absolutely do.
And one of Philip's friends, Spencer, is used to procuring things for the clientele. And so this has led to him procuring the entertainment for the evening.
Yep. And Spencer wants it to be a little special for his friend Philip. So rather than just bring a stripper or two out to Westchester, he decides he's going to go with some high-end escorts. Of course, the high-end escorts turn out to be not escorts, but human traffic. Sex slaves brought recently to New York City from Moscow. Two Armenian girls who were abducted as teenagers spent nearly 5 years enslaved in Moscow before they are deemed sufficiently Stockholm-syndromed to be high-end escorts in New York City. So those are the two girls that Spencer brings out to Philip's bachelor party at Richard and Kristen Chapman's house in a Tony suburb of New York City.
Bronxville is a very upper class. I was looking on Zillow just to kind of get an idea of the real estate market there. The cheapest houses are around $600,000, the bulk between $2 and $4 million.
I choose my communities carefully. Actually, to be honest, the reason why I chose Bronxville is because I lived there for a couple of years. I went to high school at Bronxville High School. I know the roads. I know the community. I tend to doubt when I lived there, houses were quite that pricey. But it's certainly an elegant Tony neighborhood. And it's the kind of neighborhood where an investment banker, a guy who works in mergers and acquisitions and has a family, might live. There are obviously a lot of places like Bronxville in New Jersey, on Long Island, and in Fairfield County. But I loved the proximity of Bronxville to Manhattan, and I know the town.
And you said it was a Tudor home and a development of many stately Tudor homes.
It is. The difference, though, between the Tudor homes in Bronxville and the Tudor homes in other parts of the country is the ones in Bronxville aren't newly built meadow mansions. These are houses that have been around for, 75, 80, 100 years. John F. Kennedy's father, for example, lived in Bronxville. There's a lot of Tudor houses, but they are old, established Tudor houses with slate roofs that constantly need to be repaired.
It's remarked later on that it's probably the smallest house in the neighborhood.
I wanted Richard and Kristen Chapman to be neighbors, like all any of our neighbors. He's head of mergers and acquisition. He clearly makes a lot of money. But I didn't want him to be living in a spectacular, ostentatious house. It's a nice house, but I wanted it to be a house that a lot of readers can identify with. Think of that great Scott Fitzgerald idea that he always lived in the worst house in the best neighborhood or the smallest house in the best block. It was something like that. And that's kind of Richard and Kristen Chapman's house.
He isn't completely stodgy, and neither is his wife, Kristen, who is a school teacher. In their early 20s, when they first met, they were going to see punk and indie shows at CBGB's down in Manhattan.
Yeah, no, they were serious party animals in the 1920s. Not in the 1920s, excuse me. That's what I get for mentioning Scott Fitzgerald. Kristen and Richard Chapman were serious party animals in their 20s. And so now they are 40. They're middle-aged. They've got, an adorable 9-year-old daughter, Melissa. And so it never felt to me like it's a stretch for them to decide, what the heck, we will have Philip's bachelor party here. And Kristen, of course, will go into New York City with their daughter, Melissa. And the plan is that she's going to spend the weekend at her mother's apartment on 89th Street, and they're going to see a Broadway show. And three generations of women, grandma, mom, and daughter, will have a great time while Richard on Friday night hosts this bachelor party and Saturday starts winterizing the house and maybe plays a last round of golf.
The young and sex-trafficked women who are identified as Sonia and Alexandra are there, and they're there with two bodyguards/captors. And Richard is kind of dealing with this idea of stodginess in his life, and he drinks too much, and he follows suit after a lot of guys and thinking of what the women are there for.
Kristen presumes that there will be lap dances at the bachelor party. She's not precisely sure how extreme a lap dance is going to be in a Westchester home. She doesn't even know if there's going to be more than one stripper. She kind of assumes there's going to be one. There isn't. There are two, and they're not strippers. They are escorts, and they are trained to do far more than strip. And so the combination of the men's drinking, the combination of the girls' training, the reality that the Russian bodyguards are willing to let anything happen gives the men a certain amount of license that they might not otherwise have had. And so pretty soon the stripping goes to sex. And even Richard, happily married, but seriously inebriated, allows himself to be led upstairs as the best man by Alexandra to the guest room, hence the title of the book.
He does prove himself to be at least the best man of the evening because he eventually regains his senses and stops before they actually engage in sex.
And this isn't a spoiler because it's certainly in the first fifth of the novel. But yes, Richard takes Alexandra, or the Armenian girl Anahit, upstairs. And it is as she is sitting on the guest bedroom bed, naked, her feet not even reaching the floor, and he sees she's cold, the goosebumps on her thighs, that he realizes she is far closer to his daughter's age than his age, and that he's married. How did this happen? How did he allow himself to go upstairs with her? And so he draws a line and immediately exits stage left with her, and the two of them go back downstairs. But this also does lead to an interesting dilemma for Kristen, because Richard, for a variety of reasons, does tell Kristen that he was upstairs in the guest room with one of the girls. He insists nothing happened. But still, he went upstairs with her. And will Kristen ever know for sure that he's telling the truth? And why did he feel the need for her? Kristen wonders, am I not enough?
And also upstairs, there's something which I decided to start calling Chekhov's prophylactic.
Chekhov's prophylactic. Wow, say that five times fast. And I'm assuming you're referencing the Chekhov reference to a gun.
Yes.
If there is a gun on a table in Act One, it damn well better go off by Act Three. Yep. Yep, there is a prophylactic on a plastic container filled with Melissa's Barbie dolls. The Barbie dolls are an important part of the book as well. Not just the condom and what the condom signifies and all of the baggage that goes with the condom, but Barbie dolls.
Well, and their proximity to each other, showing how truly terrible this is, how it affects very young women, if not girls.
Precisely. I do not think it takes a PhD in English to see the parallels between Alexandra and Melissa and the Barbie dolls. There are actually two sort of symbols in the book that I thought about a lot when I was writing it. The Barbie dolls and a couch, and what the couch signifies.
Now, you said that it's pretty laissez-faire. The bodyguards didn't really set many limits, but one of them they did set was no cell phones, no pictures, no video.
And as a matter of fact, that is a rule of thumb at most bachelor parties, even those that do not have escorts. The bodyguards will usually insist, you know, no photographs, no videos, don't even think of getting out your phones for the next few minutes during the talent's performance. So this was simply a stretch upon that rule of thumb.
And things do get rather debauched. The groom-to-be actually cheats on his fiance, and Richard coming very close to committing adultery, and then things go wrong, and not like in a wacky The Hangover.
No, this book isn't The Hangover. No.
This is more Reservoir Dogs or Very Bad Things, Things Go Wrong.
You know, it's funny you said that. When my wife read the first draft of the book, she turned to me in bed and she said, wow, you've done it. The Bonfire of the Vanities meets Breaking Bad. And that was the ultimate compliment, because she certainly loved Bonfire of the Vanities, as do I, and we both just loved every episode of Breaking Bad. But yes, I knew what she meant. In the first chapter of the novel, the two sex slaves, and that's what they are. We've been using euphemisms such as, you know, escorts and human traffic. Make no mistake, these are sex slaves. Are brought by their Russian captors out to this lovely house in Bronxville. And for a variety of reasons, the two girls choose that party and that moment to kill their Russian captors and escape into New York City and Times Square. So if you're Richard Chapman, how do you call your wife on the phone and explain to her, honey, don't come home this weekend. The house is a crime scene and there are two dead Russians in the living room. And oh, by the way, I was upstairs in the guest room with one of the girls. How do you explain that to your 9-year-old daughter? And how do you explain that to your partners at the investment bank on Monday morning when you're on the front page of the New York Post? And the rest of the book, I hope, chronicles Richard's spiral, just the nightmare that unfolds for him professionally and personally, but also the nightmare for Alexandra. Because as difficult as Richard's life is, it is nothing compared to what Alexandra and Sonia have to experience underground now and on the run from the police and from the Russian gangsters who they know will kill her in a heartbeat.
And we really don't even get the dimension of the neighborhood's reaction, because I'm sure people who live in Bronxville just love Russian gangsters and sex slaves shooting up the place.
There are a couple of oblique references to what Richard calls the vultures, or the news vans that are constantly circling. And there are a few oblique reactions to some of the neighbors in the texts on Saturday when the neighbors see the mobile crime lab on the street or the news vans. But no, this is a book that I hope is essentially from really four perspectives. There's some secondary characters, but three Americans and one Armenian. The Americans, Kristen and Richard Chapman, husband and wife, their daughter Melissa, and Alexandra, the Armenian sex slave. And I wrote the book in alternate chapters. There are third-person omniscient chapters from the perspective of the Americans, and then there's Alexandra's first-person narration. It was a very conscious decision to give Alexandra the only first-person voice, because rarely does a sex slave in this world have a voice. And I wanted to make sure that Alexandra had among the first words and the last.
With Melissa having a point of view, I thought that was also very unique, too, to see the child's point of view of this very difficult situation.
I love writing about kids. I'm a dad of a daughter, and it's always important to me when I can to have moments in the book in which the action is witnessed from a kid, because kids obviously bring to these sorts of cataclysms a very, very different perspective, and sometimes it's less jaded, it's more innocent, and it sometimes allows us to see ourselves in the best possible light and our motives in the best possible light. I write a lot about dread, and I think I write about dread because I'm a dad of a daughter. The two people I love most in the world, who I always love most in the world, are my lovely bride and my daughter. And so I think I have such anxieties about something bad ever happening to either of them. And that fills a lot of my fiction.
Of course, we need conflict for drama, but man, you have a lot of people go through terrible, terrible things in your books.
I do. I really, really do. Sometimes it's my worst fears, and sometimes it's just the fears that I think we all have. You know, I write two kinds of books. I write historical fiction, such as The Sandcastle Girls, a big sweeping love story set in the midst of the Armenian genocide, or contemporary literature, such as The Guest Room. But all those books, I think, share two things. They share dread, and they share a kind of person that my daughter first singled out. My daughter's a 22-year-old actor. She lives in New York City. When she read a rough draft of Close Your Eyes, Hold Hands, she said something to me that was really astute. She said, "Dad, take this as a compliment because I mean it that way. But I think your sweet spot as a writer is seriously messed up young women." And she's right. When you look at all my books, whether they're historical fiction or they are contemporary literature, I think the heart of the book is a smart, courageous, beautiful, interesting, and emotionally or physically scarred young woman. I mean, I think the heart of The Guest Room is Alexandra. In The Sandcastle Girls, it's all those girls and young women who survived the Syrian deserts and the Armenian genocide. In The Double Bind, it's a young social worker's descent into madness after a cataclysmic sexual assault. In Secrets of Eden, it's a teenage girl named Katie who's an orphan after a domestic violence, murder, suicide.
So where do you think this particular ability and focus comes from?
I think it comes from my fear that I want nothing bad to ever befall my beautiful daughter.
Now, with the sense of dread, do you think that's linked in part of the cultural history and psychology of the genocide?
Yes, absolutely. I'm really glad you brought that up. There are parallels between The Guest Room and The Sandcastle Girls. Sometimes when I think of the two books, I know it's now January 2016, but when I think of the books, I think 1915 and 2015. The Armenian genocide began on April 24th, 1915, and as Pope Francis said on the centennial of it in April 2015, it is an open wound today for Armenians around the world because it remains an unpunished crime. The systematic annihilation out of three out of every four Armenians living in the Ottoman Empire during the First World War.
Additionally, the Pontic Greeks and the Assyrians as well.
Another 300,000 Assyrians, you're right, and the Greeks. And the fact is, almost all the Armenians today are descendants of those final survivors. So when I look at a girl like Alexandra or Anahit, she, of course, is a descendant of survivors. She even talks about it in a couple of points in the novel. Once when she is imprisoned in Moscow and she's feeling guilty that she hasn't taken her own life because she thought of all of the Armenian women, now widows, their children killed, who killed themselves rather than be further defiled. She thinks again of it when she's looking at St. Vartan's Cathedral in New York City, when she's there with her Russian captors and is afraid to go inside out of guilt and shame.
Also, you do mention just very briefly in the book, make a reference to Nagorno-Karabakh,
I do,
which is still a contested oblast of Azerbaijan, but almost, what, three-quarters Armenian in the area?
I can't believe there are any Azeri citizens living now in Nagorno-Karabakh, just as there are no Armenian citizens living now in Azerbaijan. The thing about it, Nagorno-Karabakh that just I think is terrific is what a thriving, wonderful democracy it has become in the last 20 years, while Azerbaijan is a despicable thug dictatorship now.
An enclave of Armenian ethnically people who live entirely within the borders of Azerbaijan.
Yes, though I tend to view Nagorno-Karabakh as an independent republic just waiting for recognition.
I had heard of it because I studied Soviet history in college. I was a political science major. But it's amazing that it still hasn't settled the war between the Azeris and the Nagorno-Karabakh people.
And it's,
that
like
it's still, the ceasefire is still violated from time to time.
All the time. Oh my gosh, the ceasefire is violated all the time. I don't think a week goes by when I don't read about Nagorno-Karabakh young men being killed at the point of contact by sniper fire or even most recently mortar fire. And I'm glad you mentioned the Soviet Union, because when we think of human trafficking and sexual slavery, we usually think of the Far East. We think of Thailand. We think of the Philippines. But it was when the Soviet Union collapsed, the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1990, that it became a more Western phenomenon. Because all of a sudden, all of the Soviet republics, all of the satellite nations in Eastern Europe, their economies fell into absolute disrepair. And who's at the bottom of any economic system always? Women and young girls, which is what has led to a burgeoning sexual slavery market in the Caucasus, in Russia, and across Europe. I gather that almost all of the sex slaves in Italy, for example, are Romanian or Moldovan.
Now, you say this gives rise to sexual slavery in the market, but what really gives rise to the market is men who pay for these people.
Well done. I agree. Sex business is extremely price elastic. The more it costs, the less it's used, which is why sexual slavery is important, because that means the price can be really pretty low. And yes, so men drive the business. Men drive the business in the East. Men drive the business in the West.
And these are our fathers, our brothers, and our friends who are doing this.
Right. Yep. And they are men who are somehow capable of this spectacular compartmentalization and look at a young girl and not see their daughter or their granddaughter, not see their niece, not see their wife or ex-wife or mother.
Just as it is with violent crime, I mean, this is so male-centered. I mean, it's amazing that we aren't held to more account.
There needs to be not simply greater fines. There needs to be greater penalties for all kinds of sex trafficking businesses. And one of the things that's really interesting, January is National Human Trafficking Awareness Month. And one of the reasons for that, I've always assumed, though I don't know this for a fact, is that it's the month when you run up to the Super Bowl. The Super Bowl is one of those pivotal points in the calendar year when there's an opportunity to raise awareness of this issue and try to dial down the demand among men. Because wherever the Super Bowl city is, there's a lot of sexual slavery. There's a lot of human trafficking. The girls are often brought there. So sometimes there have actually been efforts to have soaps in all of the motels and all of the hotels near the Super Bowl with the hotline so that sex slaves or young people in forced sexual exploitation can text or call if they can get a hold of any phone that, you know, they are in need of help. It's just one of the small things you can do. And yeah, if we can make it clear that there are penalties, this is not a victimless crime. There are penalties for men to be involved for partaking as well as selling. I think that's just a wonderful thing. There's an organization called the Coalition to Abolish Slavery and Trafficking in Los Angeles, castla.org. There are a lot of groups that work on this, but that's one particular group that I always like to single out for their efforts to dial down our willingness to tolerate human trafficking.
And it must be extremely heartbreaking to write this, to have to inhabit this world day after day after day, and then also to realize that it is just not Anahit, it's just not Alexandra, it is so many.
Siddharth Khara, who wrote the book on sexual slavery, he teaches at Harvard, he estimates that there are somewhere in the neighborhood of 1.2 to 1.5 million young women, girls, and boys trafficked across international borders for sexual slavery. The International Labor Organization believes human trafficking is a $150 billion business. That includes all kinds of slavery, but it's a huge business.
Now, to go from this very tragic to more ridiculous matters, there is one small insignificant bit that didn't ring true for me in the book.
Okay.
And it was about Melissa listening to the TV at a lower volume than her parents. Because I went to hundreds of punk and metal concerts when I was young, and my partner's 10-year-old daughter just cranks that TV up unbelievably loud for me.
You might be absolutely right. I am basing that not on the way my daughter would modulate the television volume when she was that age, but the way my late father would listen to the television set at Jet Engine whenever I would be visiting. So I made perhaps the inadvertent and erroneous extrapolation that if my dad listens to his TV louder than I do, I must listen to it louder than my daughter. I stand corrected.
And a small point about the cover of the book, it features a blonde woman, and Alexandra was very dark-haired, coal-haired, as they said. Why do you think Doubleday went with a blonde woman on the front?
I do love that cover, and I think they just found the image that most exemplifies the tone and feel of the book. We did discuss, can we airbrush her blonde hair to black? And they couldn't figure out a way to airbrush the hair.
Because of the lace curtain.
Because of the lace curtain, yeah. Yeah. And so there was talk of maybe we do need to find an image of a young woman with dark hair, but that image is just so perfect. It's, you know, it's actually one of my favorite covers I've had. And I've had some really lovely covers thanks to Doubleday.
Now, you mentioned the Sandcastle Girls, and I understand that's going into production as a film soon?
Yes, that's exactly right. Yep. The Sandcastle Girls is such an important book to me. The Guest Room and the Sandcastle Girls are bookends, and they're both so important to me. The Sandcastle Girls is set mostly in Aleppo, Syria in 1915, though there are scenes in Gallipoli and there are scenes in the present in and around Bronxville and Boston at the Armenian Library and Museum of America. And yes, an immensely gifted filmmaker named Eric Nazarian has given his heart and soul the last 3 years to not simply write a breathtaking screenplay, but to raise the millions of dollars necessary to film The Sandcastle Girls. He will be filming it in Spain and New England this summer. He will be announcing casting shortly. But it'll be one of those, you know, magnificent, big-budget Hollywood epics that we don't make enough anymore. Movies like The English Patient and Atonement. And his screenplay is so much better than my book. It is a breathtakingly good screenplay.
I'm guessing the Turkish government wouldn't be open to filming there.
No, this would not be filmed in Turkey. And it's obviously it can't be filmed in Aleppo, Syria. It's very difficult to get Hollywood to ensure production anywhere in the Middle East right now, which is why he's filming in Spain.
You talk about how you write contemporary and also historical fiction, but it seems that just the settings and the situations you put your characters in are so manifold. It must be such hard work to create these new worlds over and over again instead of being maybe a genre writer who does a series and can inhabit one world continuously. You're always world building, it seems.
You know, I never thought of it like that, and I'm very flattered you would say so. Thank you very, very much. Yeah, I guess each book does begin by building a new world. I don't view it that way, however. And maybe that's why I'm not intimidated by that prospect. I'm always focused on the minutiae of the character. So I'm never looking down at it epically or globally. I'm always in the moment with Kristen or Alexandra or Richard. What does their living room look like? How would I be feeling if this happened to me? How does Kristen feel about the idea that Richard may have been with a 20-year-old sex slave? And so long as I remain with that rapier focus on the character and what they are emotionally experiencing, I don't think of it as daunting. But I guess you're right. Each of these books is very, very different, and I never do want to write the same book twice.
Are your publishers okay with that?
My publishers are amazing. I've got a spectacular editor in Jenny Jackson who is just so patient with the lunacies of what I like to write, and such a gifted editor. I will give you one example of how brilliant is Jenny Jackson, and it relates actually to the Sandcastle Girls. She read the first 100 pages, and among her suggestions and her notes, she said, "This Armenian woman, Nivart, and this girl, Hatun, I know they're only in a few scenes, but they steal this book. I love them. I want more of them. If you can do that, I just think it'll be great." And they were going to be minor characters, but they became dramatically important supporting characters. And I never would have thought that Nivart and Hatun need to be such a part of the spine of the novel.
Now, in addition to your prolific output as a novelist, just last year you gave up your weekly newspaper column. How much each of relief and of sadness do you feel about letting it go?
When you look at the scales, relief and sadness, I think they are in perfect balance. I wrote the column Idle Banter for 23 and a half years, 1,225 columns, 812,000 words, every Sunday but three for nearly a quarter of a century. It was a huge part of my life for something that was going to be under a cat's litter box about 3 hours after it appeared in the newspaper. On the one hand, I miss it because I loved writing about my dad, my mom, my in-laws, my community in Lincoln. Mostly it's about a small town in America. There's a lot of deeply personal stuff in there, you know, the deaths of friends, the deaths of parents, raising my daughter. But here's the relief. And here's when I knew it was time. I was doing a panel with the novelist Gregory Maguire. And Gregory and I were chatting beforehand. And this was in October of 2014. And Gregory reminded me that his father had been a Boston Globe newspaper columnist. And he said, "You don't write one day a week on that column. It's always in your mind. You don't, I'm sure, just like my father, you're always thinking, what am I going to write next? Because you can't have 19 blank column inches in the newspaper." And I realized he was right. It wasn't a one-day-a-week job. I was always thinking about it. And I realized that so much of my best material was now gone. My father had died. My mother had died. My mother-in-law died. My daughter had grown up and was now living in New York City. Her friends from school had all grown up and moved away. And I just realized I either need to recommit to this or call it a career. And so on the one hand, I'm really sad that I miss it. But I'm in the midst of a book tour right now. And this is the first book tour I've ever done where I didn't have to be writing on airplanes. I'm actually reading books on airplanes on this tour instead of trying to write a column and figure out what's next.
So which books have you been reading on this trip?
Okay, I'm right now reading Custer's Trials by T.J. Stiles. It is the latest biography of George Armstrong Custer. It's absolutely terrific. I just finished Garth Risk-Hallberg's City on Fire.
That could have taken you for the entire tour as long as that book is.
Yeah, no, it's true. I was about 600 pages into it when I left on the tour, but I couldn't not read the last 300 pages. It was actually the third of three books I read in a row, an inadvertent New York City doorstop trilogy. I was late to the game, But this autumn, I finally read Donna Tartt's The Goldfinch. Then I read Hanya Yanaga's A Little Life. And then I read Garth Risk Hallberg's City on Fire. How many pages is that? It's like 2,800 pages about New York City. But they were all great. They all gave me that wonderful inferiority complex I get when I read a book that is smart and the prose is luminescent and the characters are so surprising.
So that makes you feel small rather than pumping you up and giving you a challenge?
It's both. I, you know, tip my hat to so many great writers when I read books like that. And it does inspire me to want to do better.
Well, Chris, I want to thank you so much for stopping by and sharing the guest room with us today.
It was a pleasure to speak with you. And wow, do you do your homework.
Chris Bojalian is the author of The Guest Room, which is published by Doubleday. I'm Stephen Usury, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.